from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, the United States accused China's military of hacking into several U.S. businesses, including Westinghouse and U.S. Steel, to steal trade secrets. The indictment, including wanted posters with the faces of five Chinese military officers, was rebuffed by China, called hypocritical. China is many things: an economic superpower, here accused of breaking the rules, an authoritarian government trying to stop free speech in the internet age, a population of over a billion looking for meaning, looking to thrive. Longtime New Yorker China correspondent Evan Osnos takes a big, deep look at what he calls China's Gilded Age in a new book that sees parallels with the United States of a century ago. This hour on Point, Evan Osnos and China's Age of Ambition. Joining me now from Chicago is Evan Osnos, staff writer for The New Yorker. He was for years the magazine's correspondent in China, where he lived from 2005 to just last year, first reporting there for the Chicago Tribune. His new book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Evan Osnos, welcome back to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
This is an extraordinary book. I've lived in and around China for a long time, from years ago, and to see someone with your sensitivity, perception, insight come at it in this age is really a pleasure. And here it comes into this thicket of headlines. You're going deep while China's headlines are spreading out in all directions. Here they are bumping up against Vietnam, the Vietnamese burning Chinese factories, bumping up against the Justice Department, which is bumping back here, sitting down with Vladimir Putin just when he's defying the West. Does it surprise you at all to see China bumping into so many, borders of the international order as is?
It doesn't surprise me. I think, in fact, this is the hallmark of the period that we're living in, the period that's just begun for China in the world. And it's a period I call the Age of Ambition because in so many ways, China is staking out a new place for itself in the world, a new, in some ways, greater, more glorious, as it would see it, more muscular position. And that means, for instance, going out into the world and trying to obtain the natural resources that it needs, whether that's in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, which puts it into confrontation with its neighbors, or if it means signing deals with Vladimir Putin to obtain the gas that it wants in the years ahead in order to keep growing. But I think that's really going to be one of the features of the next few years, is that China is going to begin to feel out what's possible for itself as it really returns to the position that it's held for most of history, which is one of the world's most powerful countries.
The real heart of your book goes to Chinese individuals and their aspirations, their ambitions, both fulfilled and unfulfilled. And we will go at that in depth. But take us to some of these current controversies, and maybe first to the indictments coming out of the Department of Justice saying, you can't steal American trade secrets in this way. We tracked it down. We tracked it down to a building in Shanghai. Here are five Chinese military officers who have done the hacking, and we're bringing legal charges against them from the United States. China has called this hypocritical. Give us a Chinese perspective on what's transpiring here, Evan.
Well, this is an interesting case. You know, the United States hasn't taken this approach before of specifically indicting Chinese military officers. In the past, you know, the U.S., of course, has said that China is using cyber hacking in order to get access to U.S. trade secrets, as the U.S. would say. So, for instance, the design of industrial facilities or pricing details, which would then help the Chinese side in a negotiation. In this case, what they've done is they've identified specific officers, specific people inside the Chinese military, and they've put their faces on wanted posters, in effect. On the Chinese side, they say to us, look, we're coming off a year in which Edward Snowden has told the world and told the American people about the scale of U.S. cyber snooping. How is it that you have the standing to do what you do? And then the other fact, and I think this is an interesting one, is why are the Chinese doing this at all? Why are they going out into the world and looking to see what they can take from computers abroad? The reason is that on some level, they see themselves as the still the weaker party in a kind of asymmetric economic competition. you know, they look at their own country and they say there was a time 100 years ago when we were the most powerful country, really more like 200 years ago. We were the most powerful country in Asia, certainly. We controlled one-third of the world's wealth. And we're on our way back to that position. But for now, we are a developing country. And as long as we are a developing country, we will do what it takes in order to be able to compete with the United States and with other countries abroad. So they see themselves as engaged in, I think, what they would consider to be the legitimate ability to steal what you can through espionage. And they would argue that this is one of the oldest businesses in the world.
You argue that China today is something like Gilded Age America. Maybe there are more parallels than that. Go back far enough and you can certainly find young Americans or Americans of its younger years in Britain sort of memorizing the design of power looms there to bring back to the United States. Did the U.S. have a comparable attitude in its rough and ready up and coming days?
Well, it's true. I mean, if you go back, Charles Dickens used to complain that Americans were stealing all of his books and selling them on the street in pirated editions. So there is a tradition here in some sense of a rising nation that goes abroad and tries to take what it can in order to skip the process of development and of originating these designs in the first place. I think the difference, perhaps, is that we're now living in a period in which what's possible to steal and the way that it can be done is vast, and it is having an extraordinary effect. In some cases, there are American companies who believe that deals that they were in the midst of negotiating were fundamentally undermined because Chinese spies, if in fact they are operating on behalf of the government, and the evidence certainly suggests that they are, were able to get information that transformed the contours of that negotiation. The United States says, look, that is not espionage. That's just simple. They would say it is espionage. That's just that's going after the kinds of secrets that the United States does not seek to obtain for commercial advantage. And for that reason, they're going to call them on the carpet.
Then there's tension right next door. Hear the sound of Vietnamese protesters chanting against a Chinese oil rig in the South China Sea in territory claimed by Vietnam. Big oil rig there, that from AFP in the Paracel Islands, and Chinese and Vietnamese ships bumping and grinding against one another down there. Vietnamese going after Chinese factories in Vietnam violently in the last couple of weeks in reaction to that. Is China, as a regional power, is this China's beginning of a takeover of this sea? Will it be the Chinese sea?
Well, China believes fundamentally that according to its own conception of its history and its role in the region, that it has the right to control most of the South China Sea. It uses a map, for instance, that has a dashed line. It's known as the Nine Dashed Line, which extends the reach of Chinese control way down towards Vietnam and the Philippines. This, of course, is a huge irritant to the other countries in the region, the Philippines, Vietnam, and also east if you go to Japan. And the truth is that this is an issue that is going to grow in the years ahead because China, in fact, much like the United States in the 19th century, has decided that as it grows and as it becomes more powerful, it needs to control its security environment. And so what it's doing is gradually trying to push outward from its own coast in order to reestablish a new sense of normal, what it is that would be Chinese territory. I think this is, if I had to rank the potential risks for China in the years ahead, political risks, economic risks, the kinds of things that could really undermine its incredible growth story that we've seen, it's the possibility of a conflict over one of these pieces of contested territory. So it's a very dangerous process that's underway now.
And here's Chinese President Xi Jinping on another front. This is with Russia's Vladimir Putin, who's been in China, talking about that relationship between China and Russia, interpreted here by German broadcaster Deutsche Welle.
We attach great importance to the quality of practical cooperation between China and Russia. We will begin cooperating on more large-scale strategic projects to improve our two nations' power and international competitiveness.
Evan Osnos, is this the next global superpower? Is this the successor to the United States making these moves, making these deals?
I think it's easy for us to feel that way in the United States, particularly now where we're feeling vulnerable economically and we look at our political – we look at Washington, D.C., and it oftentimes seems so dysfunctional. But I think it's worth keeping in mind a couple of things that suggest that China is not prepared at the moment to take on the role of being the world's preeminent power. If you think about it, that comes with a huge number of costs. If you're the world's leading power, you have to be responsible, for instance, for policing global sea lanes to make sure that goods can travel around the world and that oil can make its place from one place to another. China at this point is not interested in taking on those kinds of costs. Also, today, China, after all, even though its economy is growing as fast as it is still, by most measurements, only about half the size in overall GDP as the American economy. The Chinese military is growing fast, but its military spending is still only about one-fifth each year of what the U.S. military spending is. You know, in the United States, we have a dozen aircraft carriers about. In China, they have one. So I think it's useful to remember that China sees some benefits in still being perceived as a developing country, a country in which the truth is your average Chinese citizen today only makes about one-sixth of what we make in the United States. And that means that it has the kind of needs and demands that a developing country has. So I think if you're trying to understand what China's ambitions are in the world, it's to become – to return to its place as a great power in a multipolar world in which there are multiple great powers and no longer simply one superpower.
Evan Osnos' new book is Age of Ambition. He takes that from a national level down to a very personal level of individual Chinese citizens. We'll look at that when we return. Evan Osnos, please stand by in Chicago. The new book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep China with New Yorker writer Evan Osnos. His new book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And it's a timely moment with everything going on in the headlines and just a couple of weeks in front of us now. June 4th will be the 25th anniversary of the massacre in Tiananmen Square, where a lot of pro-democracy protesters had gathered famously in 1989, June 4th, the 25th anniversary of the military moving in, the Chinese military moving in on its own fellow citizens in Tiananmen Square. Here's a BBC News reporter who was there describing the massacre happening behind her.
After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
Barely discussed by official China today. Evan Osnos, you go further back to Deng Xiaoping and his giving the green light for Chinese to act on individual initiative. I want to look at Tiananmen and how it resonates today, but take us even further back. You remind us of a tiny little experiment when China was still very poor, way back in the boondocks of China, where farmers just weren't making it, and they decided to experiment quietly to let one another out of the communal system to farm for their own benefit. And what that meant in that little village and how it boomed into the entire national upsurge that we have seen since.
You're absolutely right. If we look at this extraordinary Chinese boom and we try to trace it back to the earliest moments, what you find is that in 1978, 1979, China was, let's remember, incredibly poor. In fact, it had a lower per capita income than North Korea, to put it in perspective. So it was an unbelievably poor place. And the socialist model, which was about collective farms and factories, had not delivered on the promise that people wanted. It simply had left people in poverty. And so there was a village, in fact, where the farmers had become so poor that they had been roaming the county begging. And finally, at the end of this process, they realized they have no choice but to try something else. And so what they did is signed a pact with each other to take care of their families in the event that they were arrested for what they were about to do. And then they dissolved their collective farms and began to farm on their own. The local party officials at the time, at first, said they denounced it. They said, this is an outrage. This is an insult to socialism. But in Beijing, there were people around Deng Xiaoping and Chen Yun and some of the other senior leaders who recognized that this experiment might in fact point their way to survival for the Communist Party and ultimately for prosperity for China. And so eventually this experiment was adopted across the country. And what you see today is that this country, which in so many ways was bound by these collective arrangements in which people would farm together and produce together, manufacture together, they were given the opportunity to go out on their own. And it was only when they were given that chance to go out individually that it unleashed this enormous economic might, which we see today.
You describe this transformation at 100 times the scale and 10 times the speed of the first industrial revolution, which, of course, created modern Britain. Billionaires, the fastest growing source in the world now, China. China as the biggest consumer of all kinds of things, from beer to platinum in the world. And yet inside that ride, a billion plus Chinese with all kinds of attitudes about what's going on. Let's just start with ambition. This is the age of aspiration, ambition in China. Define that for us, the sort of stripes of ambition that you found there, top to bottom.
Yeah, I'll tell you what interested me, what fascinated me about this idea of ambition is that if you look back historically in China, the notion of being ambitious at all was a terrible thing. I mean, it was a pejorative. If somebody accused you of being ambitious, it was an insult. The word itself, which in Chinese is ye xin, which is, means literally wild heart. If you were accused of being wild-hearted, that was a terrible thing. But you've seen this evolution over the course of the last generation in which people now have not just the right, but really the responsibility and this very urgent need to go out and make a name for themselves. They have to figure out what they're going to do for a living. They have to figure out how they're going to make some money. They have to distinguish themselves in one form or another. All of a sudden, now, if you go into the bookstore in Beijing, as I often do, you'll find in the self-help aisles that there are books telling you how to cultivate ambition in your 20s. And so in a way, people have figured out that there are these various kinds of aspirations which are available to them. And those are, in, I think, very clearly, this is really the conclusion that I reached over the 8 years I was living there, that the aspirations to get rich, to get information, and ultimately to define what your life means, these three kinds of aspirations for fortune, truth, and faith are the engine that are driving China, the engine that's driving China through history at this moment.
You tell one of these stories. It's an incredible story. It's as if it were out of a thriller of a Chinese army captain, but not mainland Chinese, from Taiwan, who back at the same time when this was just beginning to unfold, walked into the water on Taiwan, swam across the Formosa Straits there to mainland China, and commenced on his own journey. So many journeys set off by this unleashing of ambition in China. Describe the journey just a little bit of Lin Zhongyi.
Yeah, he's a fascinating case. And I remember when I came upon his story, I thought in so many ways this is a sort of grand metaphor for what the Chinese people have done all across the country. In 1979, he was a young army captain, 26 years old, and in Taiwan. He was posted to an island, which in Chinese is called Jinmen, and in the West is called Quemoy. People might remember it from the Cold War as a great sort of outpost in the struggle between communism and the West. And he was posted to this island very close to the Chinese mainland, and that was because he was one of the great true believers in the Taiwan cause. Taiwan, you'll remember, was at odds with the mainland. Taiwan was home to the Nationalist Party, and they were the side that had lost in the Chinese Civil War. And so they declared themselves the opponents of the Communist Party on the mainland. In 1979, when China was so poor, Lin Zhongyi stood on that island and said, I think that China will rise in the future, and that's where my future is. China will rise, and I will rise with it. And he made this almost impossibly difficult decision to leave behind his wife and his child, and he had another child on the way, and he swam to the mainland because he thought that's the only place that he could actually achieve his future. It was only about a mile swim, but obviously it was a dangerous thing to do. If he'd been caught, he would have been executed as a traitor. When he got to the mainland, he started over. He changed his name, and he dedicated himself, in a sense, to becoming one of the economic minds behind China's rise. He ended up, in fact, becoming the chief economist of the World Bank, the first Chinese person to be the chief economist of the World Bank. And he eventually, I should say, he reunited with his wife and his children. But his life, that journey, that sense of risk-taking, that somehow that almost audacious belief that China was going to become as important as it is, in many ways, I think, pointed me to this broader story of what it is that is driving China. And that's that on some individual level, all across the country, people are taking risks like that all the time.
And with outcomes that can be absolutely eye-popping. You've got plenty of Gatsby-esque stories in here. I mean, you go back to Mark Twain and F. Scott Fitzgerald to find American writers writing about comparable times. But these rags-to-riches stories can be incredible. The fortunes, absolutely enormous. Who rises and who doesn't in China?
That's a key question, Tom. I think, and that's one I can tell you that the Chinese talk about all the time. You know, the reason I got interested in these American comparisons is because I thought to myself, if I'd been living in the United States 110 years ago, who would I have talked to? Who would tell the tale? And there's a lot in common. You know, the United States, after all, was coming out of the Civil War, much the way that China was coming out of the Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. It was a time in which the United States was laying railroad tracks from coast to coast. China has built more high-speed rail than the rest of the world combined in the course of the last generation. And the question today is it possible to succeed in the Chinese system if you don't have the kinds of connections and you don't have the advantages that a small group has? So these days, the big question, this is what reminds me of the Gilded Age, both in America 100 years ago, and you could argue perhaps some of the same questions we're struggling with today in America, is are the gains of prosperity being shared fairly and equally? Are they, in fact, is opportunity available to everyone, or has it concentrated into the hands of a very few?
Evan Osnos writes, when I stood in the light of a new Chinese skyline, I sometimes thought of Gatsby's New York. Quoting here F. Scott Fitzgerald, always the city seen for the first time in the first wild promise of all the mystery and the beauty in the world. I guess my question still stands a little bit, though. Out of this billion plus, who does make it? Is it Chinese party stamp that decides who becomes the zipper king, manufacturing and making billions for the world, or just somebody who's got the gumption, the willingness to do anything? How do Chinese look at who makes it?
There are a few pathways to success in China, and there was a period, particularly in the early years after this economic boom began, when any kind of wily, gritty character could figure out a way to get rich. So, for instance, I followed the story of a woman who figured out that the United States, as she said, was the Saudi Arabia of garbage. It produced an enormous amount of garbage. And if she could get that to China and recycle it into cardboard and cardboard boxes, which were then stamped made in China and sent back to us in the United States, she could get rich. And in fact, she did get rich. She became the richest woman in China. So there are stories like that that are, in so many ways, they remind us of a Horatio Alger story. And then at the same time, China is, after all, a country in which it has weak institutions like the courts, and there's no oversight. The nature of the political system today makes it incredibly vulnerable to corruption. And so some of the stories that I tell in the book, some of the people that I've followed, are in fact people who were spectacularly corrupt and figured out that this was a system that they could manipulate to their own advantage because they had connections. And one example I'll mention is a man named Liu Zhixiang, who was the head of the railway bureau in the city of Wuhan, and he had a good job because his brother was the minister of railways. And Liu Zhixiang figured out that if he could take a tiny piece of every train ticket and he could put that money in his pocket, he could get rich. And in fact, it worked out much better than he even thought, and it posed something of a problem to him. He was generating so much cash, and it was piling up in his home so fast that when they finally caught up to him, when the police finally arrested him, the cash was moldering in his house. It was turning to dust because it had accumulated in such quantities.
There's volume, but even that probably doesn't compare to some of the big industrialists. All that aspiration for fortune, you also look at the aspiration for truth. And here, again, a Western sense of what goes on in China is hard to square or to flow into what actually happens in China. We hear all the time about controls. Chinese, as you write, are very aware of that as well. What's that search for truth like?
Well, what happened basically is that people, as they started to get rich, as they started to accumulate a little bit of property, they realized, I can no longer afford to be ill-informed about the world around me. I have to understand who's setting the rules in this country. Who's deciding policy? What are the policies? Do I have any impact on them? And that created a market for a kind of investigative community. And all of a sudden, you had editors and journalists, for instance, who would go out and realize, even within the confines of the censorship system, and the confines are serious and severe, that I can, they figured out that they can do real work. And so I write about an editor named Hu Shu Li, for instance, who decided, I am going to apply as much rigor and scrutiny to the Chinese economy as a journalist in another country would to their own economy. And as a result, she was able to produce a huge number of breaking stories. She was able to scoop her peers, and she created a market, and people all of a sudden started to buy her magazine, which was called Cai Jing. And as a result, she also created a whole generation of young journalists who believe that it is possible, and in fact, it is their responsibility to seek out information, to seek the truth as they see it. And now you see that on the web as well. The web has created this entire infrastructure which allows people to go out and do, in effect, their own process of information gathering, whether it's by collecting photographs of party officials and showing that they have bought fancy cars that they really shouldn't be able to afford. In one form or another, people have discovered that within the, you know, even though they run the risk of stepping across that line and being punished for it, they're willing and they want to push it as far as they can. And they you see this desire for truth, for lack of a better term, over and over again.
Evan Osnos writes, the Chinese people have outpaced the political system that nurtured their rise. The party has unleashed the greatest expansion of human potential in world history and spawned perhaps the greatest threat to its own survival. The new book is Age of Ambition. Callers for you, Evan, there in Chicago. Tom's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Tom. You're on the air with Evan Osnos.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
I have a question about... I always think about the future of my grandkids, and I was wondering how scared we should be, how proactive we should be in our dealings with not only with China, but if there's any knowledge with the rest of the world. We hear all these facts, but in the long term, I guess I'm wondering if one of you could put your what do you call that? Anyway, if you could tell me the
should we be scared? Our time, mind. Yeah. Well, Tom, I think we've got it, and let me pick it up right there with Evan, if I may. Okay, here it is: biggest, fastest rise ever in world history. It's got all kinds of aspiration and energy behind it. Should Americans be frightened? What kind of interaction, what kind of relationship should this country aspire to with China?
I don't think we should be scared. I think we should be alert, and we should be aware, and we should be educating ourselves. If we think about it, you know, the United States over the course of our history has encountered large powers before. Sometimes it's threatening. If you think back to the Soviet Union, obviously these were two fundamentally different ways of viewing the world. You know, they had an affirmative ideology that they were seeking to export around the world. And we saw ourselves in this deep contradiction and competition with the Soviet Union. It's a different situation today. Our relationship with China is unlike any we've ever had before. You know, we bring in $400 billion worth of goods from China every year. We send $100 billion over to them, $100 billion in goods. So we have this incredibly important economic relationship. And then on a deeper level, you know, the Chinese today don't get up every morning and say we're seeking to export our political way of life. That's not exactly how they see it. What they see is that the United States has something that they, in many ways, we have things here that they want. You know, we have educational institutions that they admire. There are 80,000 Chinese students, for instance, who are in the United States studying. The president of China, his daughter, is studying at Harvard under a pseudonym. That gives you some sense of the admiration that they have for what we do well. But what I think we want to do for ourselves is remember that we are in some ways at our best when we're attracting the best people from countries around the world, and including from China.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep China with New Yorker writer Evan Osnos. His new book, after 8 years in China, is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Lots of comments online here, Evan, for you. Here's one from Zheng Liu. It says, the anger of the majority of China's young generation is about to boil over. Without a virtual enemy to be blamed for all the dysfunctions, the current regime is on the verge of collapse. to find or create or hype a military conflict as the only way to salvation. What do you say to that view, Evan?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that comment in the sense that as the economy slows down, and the economy, after all, really has been the pillar of Chinese political legitimacy over the last generation, that you've seen that the government is allowing people and in some cases encouraging people to rally around the flag and to unify around a shared sense of the glory of China. And that can take on an aggressive edge because what it means is that if China feels that its interests are being threatened, for instance, in those territorial disputes we were talking about before with Vietnam or with Japan, that means that people will take to the streets to say we're standing up in China's name. I think this is a pattern we've seen over the course of history is that when countries feel that they're imperiled, oftentimes the government will turn people back to an image of themselves that can pull them together. But it's also, I would point out, I think it's a risky proposition because a lot of these young nationalist demonstrators in some cases are joining these protests because that's what's available to them. You know, they have a lot of complaints. They complain about high housing prices. They complain about the fact that it's hard for them to get jobs that use all of their skills after they paid all this money for their college educations. But they're not able to demonstrate on that subject. They're allowed to protest on the subject of Japan, for instance, and its occupation of China during World War II. But that can easily turn in another direction. And so the government keeps a very close watch on these demonstrations, even at the same time that it's allowing them to continue.
Here we are on the 25th anniversary, nearly, of the massacre in Tiananmen. I read recently that China's per capita income in the years since then has gone from $400 to $7,000. You can imagine Communist Party leaders just looking at that, pointing to that and saying, you know, yes, it was a massacre, if they could concede that, but here's why we did it. Order brought us all this tremendous growth. But is there still room for that kind of internal conflict? You say that your book itself at bottom is about the collision of two forces, aspiration and authoritarianism. Where does that collision go?
That's the crux of it. And this is the thing that in the end is the most interesting fact about China today is that they've unleashed this immense range of different aspirations. And we've talked about some of them. It's the aspiration to get rich, for instance, or the aspiration to go online and become known as a commentator, somebody who says things that are critical or funny or entertaining. All of those kinds of things put people into confrontation with what the system can accept. Because after all, today's Communist Party is in many ways an unreconstructed Marxist-Leninist party of the kind that it was when it came into power in 1949. The party believes at the highest levels, it believes that it has served the country well. It has allowed people to lift themselves out of poverty. And it's not willing to give up that kind of political system. And it worries that if it even makes small reforms around the edges, that could lead ultimately to the downfall of the party. And so what you have is a system in which the political system is ossified and rigid, and then the popular experience, the actual experience of being Chinese and living out in the world has become diverse and unruly and it's expanding in all of these different directions. And so you get this culture clash between the solemn party and the sheer diversity and color of the society outside.
How does that resolve?
Well, it resolves probably in the long term with the party having to make an accommodation, and the reason meaning that it will probably have to change itself in some form or another. Because if you think about it, there are two forces here that are in collision with each other, and one of these forces is not going back in the bottle. The fact is that the Chinese people today are not willing to give up the aspiration that they have acquired over the last 30 years. You know, it's the center of their lives. They've acquired the ability to make all of these decisions for themselves about all kinds of things. And that cannot be taken away. And the party knows that can't be taken away. If they tried to take it away, the political system would not survive another day. So what it means is that the party is going to have to figure out a way to allow people to take more control out of their lives. And probably this means they're going to have to re-examine things like the censorship system. You know, China today has the world's largest system of censoring human expression. And that's totally at odds with the world in which they live, in which people have all of this control over their lives. But, you know, I think one thing we have learned over the last 40 years is that the we've on a number of occasions, and I've certainly done it, we've all predicted that the Chinese Communist Party, there's just no way they can live another day. How can this go on? It's this antique of another age. And when that happens, what they do is that they adapt themselves. They adapted themselves in 1979 when they gave up socialist economics. And I think what's a likely scenario, or at least the kind of scenarios we should be thinking about, are ways in which the party will seek to hold on to its organization, meaning its leadership, its membership, but also redefine itself so that it gives people greater control over their daily lives. Can they pull that off? That's the big question.
Then you take us even another layer deeper to what you call the search for a new moral foundation in China. As you describe it, as men and women on the bottom rung of the middle class set out in search of what to believe, where does that take them? Where did it take you in following that trail?
Well, if you think about it, you know, China, we often think of it as a society that's not a religious place. And it's true that it doesn't have the religious culture that we would recognize, for instance, churches on every street corner kind of thing that we have in the United States. But as recently as the late 70s, China was a religious place in the sense that Chairman Mao was virtually a god in people's lives. And so there was this, you know, you would – students, for instance, would literally go and confess their sins at the foot of a Chairman Mao statue. And then all of a sudden that was gone. Socialism of that kind, and certainly Chairman Mao's image of that kind, disappeared when the party embarked on the free market. And so all of a sudden you had this gaping hole, a kind of spiritual void, as they call it in Chinese. It's known as a jingshan kongxu, which just means a hole in the center of your spirit. And people have filled it themselves. And so that's why we're living through this period in China today where it's much like the United States in the 19th century with the Great Awakening, in which all of a sudden you've got as many Christians in China as there are members of the Communist Party. And people are seeking out all kinds of different religions and philosophies. And why are they doing it? They're doing it because they look at the country around them and they say, well, the free market has given me all kinds of economic opportunities, but it doesn't tell me what I stand for as a human being, for instance. It doesn't tell me what my life, what my purpose is here. It doesn't tell me what my relationship should be to my neighbor or to my parents. There's all kinds of moral questions about how to live a good life, a decent life, that are not addressed by the most bare bones economic doctrine that underlines so much of Chinese life. And so that's the search for meaning, and you see it all over the place. Anybody who's been to China in recent years has probably run into somebody who has said that they're in the process of exploring some religious community because that's become very much a part of life.
We took On Point to Shanghai just a couple of years back, and I was just astonished at on a Sunday morning, a church on a major street in Shanghai, the church and the entire lawn and grounds around it, shoulder to shoulder, absolutely crammed on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, in Beijing, my wife and I lived in an area that was flanked on either side by two different temples. One was the Lama Temple, which is a Tibetan temple, a Tibetan Buddhist temple. And on the other side, it's the Confucius Temple. And I would see people who would go to one temple, and then they would go across the street and go to another temple.
Wow.
And in a sense, it's because they're still figuring out how do these different traditions fit into their own history and then also into their own lives. So it's a fascinating time to be paying attention to religion in China. Though I have to say, if I was going to guess, and there is a huge amount of interest in Christianity, but if I had to guess, I would guess that China is not going to become a Christian nation. Simply in the – it's more likely to absorb these traditions from abroad, take of it what they want, just as they have with Marxism and free market capitalism, and then reinterpret it for its own purposes.
As they did with Buddhism. Franklin, Tennessee calling. Tom. Tom, you're on the air with Evan Osnos.
Hi there. Glad to talk with you. I think my question was kind of being answered. The thing I'm a bit concerned about is I have some friends who have gone to China, and I've had some educators, and they've come back and said there was no moral or ethical standard in the sense that they have no problem taking advantage of any situation they can to make money. And therefore, you know, stealing from us is not a problem for them. Stealing our ideas or whatever, that just means they're smart and they can get ahead. Is that something we need to accept or understand?
Tom, let us look at that. Evan, I mean, you talked about the moral vacuum after Maoism fell. Chinese themselves have written and bemoaned that, but what about our caller's observation?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that this is really a Chinese conversation that's going on now. And I watched that develop over the course of the 8 years that I was living there. When I moved there, it really was the Wild West in 2005. I mean, it was a place in which you could basically do anything you could get away with. If you were a Chinese factory owner, for instance, nobody was really going to come to you and tell you that you couldn't be using these dangerous chemicals in your products. And the most famous demonstration of that was a terrible case in which, in 2008, children who were drinking infant formula were sickened by the addition of a chemical into this baby formula. Mm-hmm. And this case became a national phenomenon. And people said, what have we become? How is it that our own factories are putting chemicals into their products, knowing that it might harm children? So that focused the conversation. And what you saw was that people are talking about it now. And they look at their own officials, for instance, in power, and they say, how is it that these people can steal so much money and not feel as if they're violating a public trust? So what I would say is that, yes, it is a place these days, very much so, in which it feels like the kind of moral foundation of the society has become unfastened. And Chinese talk about it that way. But I'm encouraged by the fact that they're talking about it at all and they're looking for solutions. I think the challenge for the Communist Party, of course, is are they going to be the ones to provide that solution, or are they going to be incapable of doing it? Is the political system as it's arranged today, with institutions that have no oversight, for instance, and courts that are easily vulnerable to outside influence, are they going to satisfy what people want from public morality? My guess is that it's going to be very difficult for them to do so.
Let's get a call from New York. Burdett, New York. Mike is calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Evan Osnos.
Hi. My question is this. I've been listening to the conversation, and one thing I have not heard anything about is China's phenomenal exploitation and consumption of the world's natural resources. Mm-hmm. It's growing at a horrific rate, and they are literally gobbling up Africa, South America, and Southeast Asia. And that's hardly sustainable at their population level. And, and I really think that China's rise to superpowerdom takes with it much of the world's natural resources, and that something that affects the security of the whole entire world. And I think that needs to be addressed in this equation.
Mike, let us pick it up right here. Natural resources and perhaps with that, the environment itself. What do you think when you look at China's vast appetite, vast needs, and its own outlook on the environment at home and abroad?
The caller's absolutely right. This has become one of the defining facts of our time, is that as Chinese lives become similar or more similar to our own, the consumption habits are putting a toll on the planet that we're really not able to manage. I mean, there are estimates, and they're credible estimates, that for Chinese citizens to live at the level of consumption in terms of, for instance, how much meat and how many cars we drive and how much we consume, how much paper we use, that it would require an additional planet in order to satisfy that demand. I've, over the years, gone to various places to investigate this kind of thing. And I went down to Papua New Guinea once a few years ago to look at the way in which Chinese demand for timber had transformed their economy. And over the course of just a few years, all of this timber that had been going to other countries was now going to Chinese ports. And it is a serious issue. And I should say, this has been, over the course of the last few years, something that the Chinese government has now started to talk about a little bit more openly. They worry about the fact that they won't have enough oil to power their economy. On the other hand, they've also realized that if they don't go about this in a way that feels like a fair trade with the countries on the other side of these transactions, then it's going to isolate and alienate China from the rest of the world. That's one thing. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is that, Chinese people, when I first moved to Beijing, really, they weren't talking about air pollution. They weren't talking about the fact that the air quality on any given day in the Chinese capital is 4 or 5 times worse than the maximum level permitted by the WHO. This was really the only thing that – this was – foreigners were the only people who were talking about that. And that's changed. Fundamentally, it's changed. Today, if you're a middle-class Chinese person in a big city, it's you're almost expected just by – you're expected to be aware of air pollution because it's a measure of your sophistication. It's a demonstration that you have a sense of your own health and what it is that it takes to live a good life. And so if I had to guess, I think that the pressure on China to take a more responsible position in terms of its use of natural resources and its effect on the environment is coming from the people rather than from the government itself.
Thinking of sophisticated, your reading of China is so informed, it's thoughtful, it's generous. Will it be published in China? Will your book, Age of Ambition, be translated, published, read in China?
Well, it's an interesting problem. I love that my work over the years has been translated into Chinese and has been read in China. That's been one of the great pleasures of this period, because as soon as you write something in the New Yorker magazine, for instance, people online in China will divvy it up into Chinese, and they'll divvy it up, they'll translate it into Chinese, and they'll make it available to the people
online. But do you have a publisher? Will the Chinese government allow your book to be published in China and on the bookshelves?
No, they won't. What happened was I had received some requests from Chinese publishers to make it available in Chinese, and I offered them the manuscript, and they said that in order for it to be published in China, they would need to cut out some of the politically sensitive subjects. So, for instance, people like the artist Ai Weiwei or the blind lawyer Chen Guangcheng, who's now living in exile. And they said they asked if I would be willing to produce what they called a special edition for Chinese readers that would remove those things. And I said I wasn't. I'm not gonna change that portrait of China, because by changing the portrait of China, what you're doing is saying to Chinese readers that these things don't matter. And in my view, they do matter.
Over your 8 years, did you become more optimistic or pessimistic about China's future, Evan?
I think fundamentally I'm optimistic, because I look at what's in the minds of Chinese people, and it's dazzling.
There's a vista and a lot behind it in Evan Osnos' new book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Evan, you were great to us over the years when you were in China. It's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. I've enjoyed it.
Evan Osnos joining us there from Chicago. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.